In the year 1991, U.S. Flight 1313 soared unknowing unto its death. As the vessel sank into the ocean's depths, three boys washed ashore on Skull Face Island. Near death, pursued by vicious creatures, the boys stumbled upon shelter. Who built it and for what purpose, none could say. But, to their shock and amazement, a 55-inch TV glowed within, streaming every movie ever made.
I'd stick my neck out for nobody.
What the hell is this?
You're an inhuman monster!
I said good day!
After 20 years struggling for survival, they managed to repair the shelter's communication device. Perhaps someday, they'll be rescued. But until then, they'll watch and discuss movies, hoping, praying you're listening.
Hello there. This is Adam Frazier, and you are listening to Skullface Island, the official movie podcast of geeksofdoom.com. As always, I'm joined by...
Gone again.
David, not here. Now, I checked the bathrooms.
Definitely not there.
Not there. No sock on the knob either.
Nope.
I don't know.
Who knows?
I guess we'll find out next week or...
Yeah. Maybe he'll wander in mid-show.
Hey, you never know.
Who knows?
The voice you're hearing there is Damien's babysitter, producer Tim It's All For You Grant. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Thank you for that chilling intro for me.
Today on the show, we're going to be discussing Tim Burton's latest film, Frankenweenie, as well as Stephen Chbosky's The Perks of Being a Wallflower. But first, Martin, bring us the news.
Hello. Island update. Harold, Adam's precocious lagoon monster, is tangled in Tim's fishing net this morning.
Again? God damn it, Harold.
Martin, can you just please read the news for us?
Incoming. Movie news updates from Geeks of Doom headquarters. Oh, if I had toes, let me tell you, they'd be a curling.
Oh, come on.
Martin.
Jesus. Just get with the news already.
Battlestar Galactica star Katie Sackhoff joins Gina Carano in all-female Expendables.
Man, next.
Iron Man 3 co-writer Drew Pierce will rewrite Godzilla.
We can do better, I think.
I don't care.
Paramount to tease Latino Paranormal Activity spinoff in post-credits, Paranormal Activity 4.
Ugh, God, next.
First trailer for Shane Black's Iron Man 3, set to debut midnight October 23rd.
Well, that would be great if it was October 23rd, but it's not, so next.
Guillermo del Toro confirms he's still working on Frankenstein for Universal.
Okay.
Finally.
Interesting.
Some decent news.
The Pacific Rim director, Guillermo del Toro, he's been attached to this project for quite a while, and apparently he was just given the green light by Universal to start writing the script. He was quoted saying, we're going to start writing the script. It's a very long endeavor for me. It's going to require a couple of years just to write it.
Really?
That's
years.
Del Toro is saying that this is going to be more faithful to the classic Victorian novel, written, of course, by Mary Shelley. And he's reiterated that it's an extremely personal film for him. The quote here is, I'm trying to capture the spirit of the novel when I read it as a kid and how it impacted me. It's a very personal film. In many ways, it's the most personal film I'll ever make.
Wow.
Wow. So that's pretty exciting. I'm ready to see that. Well, thanks, Martin. That was certainly informative.
Anytime, amigos. If anyone needs me, I'll be organizing Adam's rock collection.
They're minerals, Martin. They're not rocks, all right? They're minerals. Is he out of here? Jesus. All right, It's time to get down to business. Tim, it's just you and me this time. Put on your jammers and grab the raisinettes. After unexpectedly losing his beloved dog, Sparky, young Victor harnesses the power of science to bring his best friend back to life with just a few minor adjustments. He tries to hide his home-sewn creation, but when Sparky gets out, Victor's fellow students, teachers, and the entire town all learn that getting a new leash on life can be monstrous.
Sparky is a great dog, a great friend.
The best dog a kid could have.
When you lose someone you love, they never really leave you. He'll always be in your heart.
I don't want him in my heart. I want him here with me.
The nervous system is just wires and cables.
Even after death, the muscles respond to electricity.
We are, of course, talking about Tim Burton's Frankenweenie, the black and white stop motion animated film. And I'm the only person who saw it.
That's right.
So I'll just go ahead and talk about it, and you can listen. It's funny, only Tim Burton, someone who's so hit or miss, but mostly miss lately, could release one of his most disappointing films of his career, Dark Shadows, and one of his finest in the same year. Frankenweenie is this great return to Burton's heyday of the 80s and 90s. It's a quirky, twisted little tale with lots of laughs and big heart. And it's very similar to, you know, Beetlejuice, Edward Scissorhands, that kind of thing. It's actually based off of a 1984 30-minute short that Burton made with Disney, which was, of course, called Frankenweenie. And that starred, I believe, Daniel Stern.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, as one of the parents. He's been trying to make this forever. And finally got a chance to make a full-length feature out of it. This film includes an all-star cast of Martin Short, Winona Ryder, Catherine O'Hara, Martin Landau, some Burton regulars in there. And the newcomer here is Charlie Tayon, who plays Victor Frankenstein. And he really kind of steals the show. He's very similar to Cody Smit McPhee and Paranorman. He portrays this likable and relatable boy who kind of lives in his own world of monsters. And I really liked it. I was not expecting to like it because I haven't liked anything Tim Burton's done in about 10 years, being gracious.
Yeah. What was the last thing?
Big Fish.
Yeah.
2003.
So what was it that you liked about it?
It just, I think he's been on such a string of adapting things for no apparent reason lately. I mean, even if you look at Sweeney Todd, adaption, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, adaption, everything he's done, Alice in Wonderland, everything's been an adaption of something that already exists. And it's just been him putting his twist on it. Whereas his best work has always been his original work, Beetlejuice, Edward Scissorhands, Ed Wood, which is obviously based on true events, but it's his film. And Frankenweenie is obviously like a labor of love for him since it was kind of his first film. So while it was extremely Burton-esque and extremely stylish, it was black and white. And so it kind of, while it did have some of the things that you notice about Tim Burton films, like the kids with pale skin and big eyes and all that stuff, that really wasn't the focus of it so much as the characters and kind of the story between the boy and his dog. So It was right there with Paranorman for me. I think they're both excellent and they're both in that same wheelhouse of the story that they're trying to tell. So
as you said, I haven't seen the movie. Saw the trailer, obviously.
Yeah.
A thought that I had while I was watching the trailer is that obviously, Frankenstein is a huge influence on all kinds of filmmakers. We just mentioned Del Toro taking it on. Obviously, Burton has some connection with it. And what it seemed to me through the trailer Burton was trying to do is take this content and reappropriate for a younger audience to get them connected to it.
The character of Victor Frankenstein, the little boy, for all intents and purposes, could be Burton as a child. He's obsessed with making home movies. He makes monster movies and, you know, the Pi 10 UFOs on fishing wire and the whole nine. So I definitely think there's a lot of Burton in there. And it really plays as a love letter, not just to Frankenstein, but to all those Universal monster movies. I mean, there's a mummy character, there's swamp monster characters, there's a female poodle who gets hit by lightning and gets the Bride of Frankenstein due. So there's tons of homages and references in there. And that, coupled with Paranorman and all the like zombie references and stuff that it made, I think they're both trying to get a new generation ready for watching horror movies.
Mm. And I appreciate that. And hopefully that was successful in this movie.
Yeah. I mean, kids were, that was the other good really thing about this movie, is not only was it gorgeous, but it both was scaring kids and simultaneously making them laugh hysterically, because it is quite funny. And, you know, subliminally, it's sneaking in these life lessons of, like, you know, the inevitability of death, and, you know, you're going to lose your pets and, you know, people that you love and things like that. So it was really charming. It's Pet Sematary Junior without Herman Munster and that creepy fucking kid. You can have your 5-year-old sit down and watch Frankenweenie, and then 6 months later have them watch Pet Sematary. You think that'll go over well?
Maybe not. All right, your rating. Let's hear it.
My rating: 1 vampire cat bat.
I like it so far.
2 coconuts, 3 bananas.
Oh, of course. Thank you.
And a fistful of sea monkeys.
Ooh. Nice. Yeah. Will that make more sense to me if I watch the movie?
It will.
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits?
Based on the best-selling novel by Stephen Chbosky, The Perks of Being a Wallflower is a modern classic that captures the dizzying highs and crushing lows of growing up. Starring Logan Lerman, Emma Watson, and Ezra Miller, The Perks of Being a Wallflower is a moving tale of love, loss, fear, and hope, and the unforgettable friends that help us through life.
C-minus, ladies and gentlemen, I am below average!
Why do I and everyone I love pick people who treat us like we're nothing?
We accept the love we think we deserve.
You see things and you understand. You're a wallflower.
I loved this movie. And again, I'm the only person who saw it.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I had a lot to do.
I understand.
David, he disappears.
Yep.
Before he disappeared, destroyed the kitchen.
What?
Trying to create some horrible tuna casserole thing.
Ugh.
I was cleaning that shit for days.
I'm sorry. Well, you missed out, because this might be my favorite movie of the year.
Wow.
I mean, it's not, I'll preface it by saying sentimental, emotional favorite. It's not, you know, the master as far as the craftsmanship on it.
Really? I'm surprised to hear you say that.
Well, Emma Watson is a cult leader, so. But the most interesting thing about this movie is it's actually, the screenplay was written and it was directed by the author of the novel. So it's this singular vision carried out to the very end. So if he feels that he needs to cut something, it's not a studio pressure or a screenwriter trying to adapt it. It's him actually retweaking his story for the screen. And you don't see that a whole lot. The film takes place in the late 80s, early 90s. So it just makes you long for all of these ridiculous things, you know, the 80s fashions and these dimly lit basement parties and that kind of imagery, which is kind of, I don't want to make this comparison.
Okay.
But you know how some of the party scenes in like Garden State.
Oh.
Oh my.
Thank God David isn't here.
Exactly. It felt like that, but in the 80s. Some of that, the way people are like hyper moving through scenes,
right,
and things like that. And the soundtrack, of course, is like the Smiths, David Bowie, New Order, Sonic Youth, like all these really kind of iconic artists of the late 80s and early 90s. And it was just great. I was really impressed. I was not expecting much at all. I haven't read the book, so I didn't know anything about it. And Emma Watson, like, I don't have anything against her per se, but after 8 Harry Potter movies, I'm ready just to hate anyone that was involved.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Like, those kids didn't start out wanting to be actors, but now they're famous and extremely popular, and they think they can be actors. Like, Daniel Radcliffe, bless his heart. I don't think he's going to do anything else. I mean, he made The Woman in Black, blah, 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 but I don't think he's really going anywhere. Emma Watson, on the other hand, has already broken free from that because she's awesome in this. And I looked at her her upcoming projects, and she's got stuff like Noah, Darren Aronofsky's really? Noah. I mean, she's got some serious projects lined up. So I would say if anyone can break the Harry Potter phase, it's going to be her. She could very well be the next, like, Natalie Portman, I would think. But she's great in it. Logan Lerman, whose only real credit that anyone knows would be Percy Jackson in The Olympians.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah. He shouldn't bring that up.
I'm sorry. He's the main character, Charlie. And he's very similar to Peter Parker. He's this very shy, awkward guy. And there's even some scenes, like, in the cafeteria where he punches a guy where I'm like, is this Peter Parker? Like, I feel like he could be bitten by a spider at any moment. But he was excellent. And Ezra Miller, who played the demented psychopath kid in We Need to Talk About Kevin, plays Emma Watson's character's stepbrother, who is adorably and outwardly gay. And, of course, is in high school and is having a tough time with that. But the ensemble is just insane beyond those three characters. You got Mae Whitman from Arrested Development,
okay.
Scott Pilgrim, Johnny Simmons, who is also from Scott Pilgrim.
Paul Rudd is in there somewhere.
Paul Rudd, I was not expecting him to show up. Dylan McDermott and Kate Walsh, I was not expecting them to show up. Joan Cusack in the movie.
Oh, yes.
And out of nowhere, Tom Savini, legendary makeup artist and star of such films as From Dusk Till Dawn and The Grindhouse double feature.
What in the world?
Tom Savini shows up as a shop teacher.
I want him to be the principal, but I'll take shop teacher.
Yeah, yeah. He's ridiculous in it. I'm not sure how he got that part or what happened there, but...
Well, he loves shop, clearly.
He loves telling people to make birdhouses.
That was a... I wish I could have seen that audition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tom, can you just stand over here with your hands on your hips and just look angry? And you got it. Congratulations. Good job. Yeah, you know, I just assumed that this movie was going to be your typical kind of angst-ridden teenage melodrama.
That's what I assume as well.
I was not expecting such a inspiring and, like, life-affirming movie. It's, for me, it's this year's Beginners. Emotionally speaking, I related to all the characters, and it just, that feeling of catharsis really came through towards the end, so.
Great ratings.
My ratings would be 5 mixtapes.
Okay.
3 not-so-brief sequences of teenage partying.
All right.
And 1 midnight showing of the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Oh, wow.
Rocky Horror plays a pretty big part in the movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Okay, You're convincing me to want to see this.
Yeah.
You're doing a decent job.
Well, thank you.
And I may see this once my chores are done, which are extensive because David's not here.
Well, of course.
Right.
And yeah, the have you noticed in movies lately, the trailers, previews, the description of why the movie is rated a certain way, there's that weird description that's like brief sequences of teenage partying. What is that?
Yeah.
Why?
And those are getting more and more descriptive.
Super descriptive.
And very random.
Yeah.
Just like I'm waiting for something like for rated PG-13 for the death of a sea turtle or something like that to come up.
Anyway, it was great. It's in limited release right now. I would imagine it will definitely get a wide release towards the end of the year or in the coming month or so. But if it's playing in your area, you should check it out. Before we move on, let's take a time out to recognize the folks that keep the popcorn stocked and the mighty T'Challa at bay.
Was that T'Challa?
I think it could have been, actually.
Shit.
Do you think that's where David is? David?
Let's not worry about it now.
Oh, God.
Let's finish the show, and then we'll brave T'Challa's den.
I'm not doing shit.
Yeah, I don't care.
Geeks of Doom has all the best geek-related scoops on comics, movies, television, and pop culture paraphernalia. And it'd be great if you could help us avoid certain death, and probably David's.
He's probably already dead.
He could be dead. But maybe not if you visit geeksofdoom.com. Now, back to the show.
Adam, do you hear that?
I hear the distinct sound of chanting.
It's the natives. They're getting restless. God. I think we should play a game to appease them.
Sure, of course. It's natural.
Remember last time, we didn't appease them?
Yes.
And David ended up on a flaming pole.
I do remember that.
Doing a pole dance.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a spear. They stuck it in the ground. They lit it on fire, and then David did a pole dance.
Right.
It was really weird.
Yeah. We don't want that to happen again.
No, absolutely not. What game are we playing today?
All right. So we are going to play Remake This. So Adam and I will each make the case for a film that we'd like to see remade.
Mm.
We're going to pitch a director-writer combo. Which, by the way, I don't have a writer involved with
that's
mine.
That's fine.
I don't have a director involved with mine either.
Literally, a rhesus monkey can direct a movie.
And we're going to cast it.
Okay.
And we're going to share it. But before we do that, I think it's important for us to talk about remakes in kind of a broader terms.
Sure, because we have a lot of our stories, a lot of our rants on the show have involved remakes.
And in general, I don't like remakes.
Okay.
And when I was preparing for this segment here, I was trying to come up with a movie that I want to see remade. I probably looked at no less than 400 movies.
Whoa.
It took forever because I was like, nope, that shouldn't be remade. Nope, that shouldn't be remade.
Sure.
That shouldn't be remade. So what I think we should do is you and I should discuss, dare I say, debate.
Okay.
When it's appropriate to remake something and when it's not appropriate to remake something.
Okay.
And maybe we should try to come to some agreement on some rules.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think that's we're doing a great service to Hollywood, who will no doubt pick up this transmission in 8 to 12 years.
Right. All right, first point here. First potential rule. Don't remake movies unless they're at least 15 years old.
Okay.
I don't think you should remake movies unless they're 30 years old. It's too soon.
Okay.
It's simply too soon. We have no ability to understand a film's impact on culture within that amount of time. You need to give it some breathing room. Give it some space. It could be, and there are great examples of this, Blade Runner. Mm-hmm. It was panned. People hated it.
Yeah.
How long did it take before people were like, holy shit, this is an incredible movie?
Yeah.
And now it's considered maybe one of the best sci-fi films of all time, if mm-hmm. not the best. It's in the top five.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now, just so I'm clear on the debate argument here, when we say remake, are we strictly saying a remake of a film, or does this include a kind of rebooting?
I think we should restrict it to remakes.
Okay, just a remake.
I think rebooting, we're going to get into the whole comic book conversation.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
yeah.
that, I mean, maybe that takes away some of your ammunition.
Maybe it does, but
yeah, this is a debate. The gloves are off, my friend.
Oh, my. Well, you know, I think 15 years, honestly, is a pretty good amount of time. I would probably agree with you to an extent that 5 years is ridiculous. But 15 years, you're allowing enough time for a technological advance at some point. You're also allowing for if the film was made off of a previous work, like a novel or something, and let's say that work was adapted and perhaps didn't meet the expectations of the fan base, someone else would step in and say, hey, I want to do this novel right.
So maybe we should put in a little side note here then. Maybe we should not include movies. Maybe we should not include adapted movies.
Original films
only.
Only?
Yeah, maybe. I mean,
it's an interesting point because, I mean, how many original films have been remade? I can't really think of many. Because, you know, The Thing is a remake of The Thing from Another World, which was adapted from a book. And I think The Thing, the 1982 one, was in the place Blade Runner was. It was panned when it came out. Mm-hmm. But now it's seen as the ultimate version of that story. Total Recall, which I hated, the remake,
right,
was a remake of the 1990 movie. But that was adapted from a Philip K. Dick novel.
Let me throw this out there.
Yeah.
Maybe a movie that popularizes
uh-huh.
a book beyond what was previously set by that book. So an example would be Philip K. Dick's, what was the novel?
Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep was Blade Runner.
Okay. So it's safe to say that novel was never as popular until.
Yeah, absolutely.
But things like Charles Dickens.
Sure.
That's always going to be remembered as a book, not a movie.
And I think that's what, yeah, like Sense and Sensibility, all those kinds of, the classic stories are constantly being remade because people want to see them interpreted by new people with new actors, you know, I mean, the Jane Austen movies that have right. cropped up lately.
So maybe that's the delineation we make, is that if a movie made popular a book, then it falls into this category of it should not be remade. As I argue against remakes.
Yes.
But if a book will always be more popular, then no matter what movie is interpreting that material, then it will.
Yeah, and I think that goes directly into my argument that would be for remaking or rebooting comic book movies, because again, those characters, those worlds were iconic way before they hit the screen.
Right. So, okay, yeah, so that works. We yeah. can agree on that. All right, let's move on. We got to get to more of these quicker.
Okay.
So don't remake auteurs.
Okay.
All right, we've established our whole book adaptation rule here, okay. or as much as we're going to here mm-hmm. at this time. So what I'm saying is you should never remake Kubrick.
Yeah.
You probably shouldn't remake I'm trying to think of Fellini. You probably shouldn't be trying to remake. Well, I mean, why try to remake Fellini?
Yeah, that's a bad idea.
These are works that are so closely connected with a person, a creator, an auteur.
Yeah, yeah.
That they should not be tampered with.
I think that is a good point, but I'm not sure if it's entirely, you know, waterproof because kind of going back to the adaption idea, you had Kubrick who adapted The Shining by Stephen King. And I would say that film is more iconic than the book. But the book was a bestseller when he optioned the rights for it. But the movie deviates from the book in a lot of ways. And so they remade it as a TV miniseries. But they kept it a lot more honest and faithful to the story, which some people preferred because they loved the book so much. Those people probably don't have an appreciation for what Kubrick did necessarily. But, I mean, David Lynch, my argument would be is here's an auteur. You know, here's someone with a very specific style who made Dune, and it really kind of failed. I would love to see Dune remade because I think now we're at a point where we have the technology. We have an audience of people who are ready to see a grand sci-fi serialized story. You know, I mean, if you look at television Lost and Game of Thrones and all this stuff, the Harry Potter movies, obviously, people are ready to take in a series of like five or six movies, which I think really is what Dune was always, it needed to be. You can't really tell that novel or that series of novels, again, adaptations, in one movie. So I think for me, it comes down to an individual basis. I would agree with you on the point that we should not remake Stanley Kubrick or, you know, some of the great filmmakers of our time. But at the same time, what if a new auteur wanted to remake an old auteur's movie? You know what I mean? Like, what if Christopher Nolan, you know, stepped out of the shadows and said he wanted to remake A Touch of Evil? I mean, Christopher Nolan's version of A Touch of Evil or Orson Welles' Mexican Charlton Heston version?
but why would... I don't want Chris Nolan to waste his time on remaking something.
Yeah.
This is my point, that they need to be moving on to new things. And this is why, in general, I don't like remakes, is because we are, and I know, you know, arguments can be made, oh, there are only however many plots.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
All this stuff. But we need to be pioneering new films and not retrenching old stories. In my opinion, there are the classics out there that are always going to have some kind of market and some kind of great purpose. But I think that we should move forward and not look back.
I think there's two points there that I want to make. And one would be that if it's a passion project for the director, then I really don't have much of a problem with it. I mean, Peter Jackson wanted to make King Kong. It was his favorite movie. And he really poured his heart into it. I thought they had tried remaking it and doing King Kong spinoffs for years. The 70s one was terrible. But I thought his King Kong was good, and it benefited from the technological advances. Also, the business side of it, a Christopher Nolan, would he have been able to make a lot of these original movies like Inception if he didn't have that Batman franchise backing him? He had to essentially reboot, remake, reinvent Batman, which gave Warner Brothers billions of dollars, $800 million for The Dark Knight alone, and that allowed him to make Inception and whatever else he wants to make for the rest of his career.
Sure. All right, we've got to move on. I'm going to read these. If anything sparks something, then respond. Otherwise, let's move on to our picks.
Okay.
All right. Don't remake movies that narratively depend on a political or social culture exclusive to a specific time period, aka don't remake movies that can't be placed in current times.
Yeah.
All right?
I agree.
And then don't remake movies whose cast is synonymous with its characters.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. But the allure there is wanting to see someone do it differently. And again, I guess it all goes back to that adaptation. If it's an original character, like let's say John Wayne's character in True Grit, you know, maybe you don't want to see anyone else touch that.
But was a book, actually.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. Yep. And I was about to say Jeff Bridges did a pretty good job.
I'll bring up Jeff Bridges again with The Big Lebowski. I feel like that is a movie that should never, ever be remade.
Absolutely.
Okay, so
absolutely.
You're gonna break the debate with that and agree with me. I win. I have won the debate, ladies and gentlemen. I am the winner.
You had Jack Nicholson as the Joker, and that's all people ever could imagine the Joker as. And when Heath Ledger got cast as that character, a lot of people were unsure of how that was going to turn out. And I mean, look how it turned out.
It's true. And now I feel like maybe no one should try that.
Exactly. Again. Yeah. Well. Yeah.
Okay. Let's hear your remake.
Well, my remake, and I don't see you having a problem with this.
Well, yeah.
There are certain genres also that I think really lend themselves to being remade. And one of those genres is horror. And my pick would be Clive Barker's 1987 film Hellraiser.
Wow. Yeah.
We have such sights to show you.
Ugh. Okay, keep going.
Tim doesn't really care for this movie, and I will not say it's a good movie. I think it has some iconic moments. It obviously made Pinhead an iconic horror character. But I think this movie could really be remade and done well if you focus on the characters and you really kind of build up this sense of nightmarish terror that is always behind the curtain in Hellraiser, but they never really succeed in bringing it forward. It's really just a bunch of gore, you know? But I would love to see someone like Ty West, who did House of the Devil and The Innkeepers, bring his very slow, deliberate style of building suspense as the director. And, you know, he usually writes his own stuff, so he'll probably write it. And then get someone in there like Eli Roth to executive produce it, who has a lot of clout in the horror community and can, you know, definitely help realize some of the more gory aspects of Hellraiser. And as far as the cast goes, I don't know if you remember these characters very much, Tim, but
I'm trying to forget them. That's why I don't like this movie. It's stuck with me.
Yeah, I mean, the original movie, I do not care for any of the actors or any of the performances or any of the characters on any level.
Yeah.
But the character of Frank, who for most of the film is like just muscle and skeleton, and he slowly becomes a person. I'd love to see Michael Fassbender in that role.
Oh, my gosh.
His brother... could be played by Bryan Cranston.
Wow.
I'll just put Bryan Cranston in anything.
I know. I'm there with you.
Rose Byrne could be Julia, the female character who kind of is sleeping with both brothers.
Yeah.
And then Liev Schreiber. Is that Liv or Liev?
Liev.
Liev Schreiber as Pinhead.
Oh, my gosh.
Why? Because he has a round head. That's why.
Well, I like it.
Okay.
It kind of goes against two rules that I established for wanting to remake a movie. Yeah. One being that I need to like the movie to want it to be remade, actually. And I know right. You won't believe me,
but
that goes along with it needs to be culturally relevant to remake. And I think, obviously, Hellraiser is plenty culturally relevant enough to remake.
Yeah.
I don't like it. But I respect it. Damn it.
Yeah.
I respect it.
But do you think, given a second chance, that it could be elevated?
I don't think so. No, because it's the source material. It just makes me feel icky.
Okay.
Can I say that?
I'm fine with that.
I'm not interested in it.
Okay.
The whole pain and pleasure thing is, you know, I know you're into that. I really wish I could forget seeing you in that gag that one time.
Sorry.
God damn it. Okay, my remake is It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. Did I say mad four times?
I think you said it six times.
There are four mads, however many I said it. I apologize. So this movie is easily one of my favorite comedies of all time, if not the favorite, my favorite comedy of all time. And what I love about it is this was in the era that they were making every movie an epic movie.
Yeah, over the top.
Over the top. Everything was anamorphic. Almost everything was in 70 millimeter. Maybe that's going a little extreme, but a lot of stuff was in 70 millimeter. Now nothing is set in 70 millimeter. I actually checked this. I wanted to see how much this movie cost. It cost $9.7 million in 1963. Inflation adjusted... makes it $73 million today.
Wow.
To give you a comparison here, most Will Ferrell comedies cost $24 to $28 million to make.
Wow.
$73 million comedy.
That is insane.
And they didn't just stop there. The cast in this movie, if you haven't seen it, is epic. It had everybody in it, all the top stars. So you got Spencer Tracy, Milton Berle, Buddy Hackett, Ethel Merman, Mickey Rooney, Phil Silvers, Jonathan Winters. Yeah. Do I need to say more? Yeah, so what I would do is I haven't assigned a director or a writer.
Okay.
I've just recast it. The story is essentially the same. It revolves around someone dying that was trying to dig up some buried treasure that he hid. It's a bunch of money. All these people go apeshit over getting it.
Sure.
Beat the crap out of each other. So I would recast the character of Russell Finch, which is this poor, meek man who's dominated by his mother-in-law, Larry David.
Yeah,
would
that's
be
good.
Finch.
Yeah,
that's his good. Mother-in-law that controls his every move. Now, I can't stand this woman, and that's why I would cast her in this role, Bette Midler.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I like
All
that.
All right. Now, Jonathan Winters plays this gullible man that drives this moving truck named Lenny Pike, Zach Galifianakis.
Yes.
Okay. Perfect. All right. Moving on. You ready for this one? You're going to love this.
Okay, I'm ready.
Two kind of buddy characters, Buddy Hackett, Mickey yep. Rooney. They play Ding Bell and Benji Benjamin.
Uh-huh.
Simon Pegg and Nick Frost.
Yes. Yes, that's perfect.
All right, and to top it all off, you got to have Captain T.G. Culpepper.
Sure, sure.
And no one, you got to go to the top. A-list, man.
Right.
A-list.
Originally played by Spencer Tracy.
Spencer Tracy. I'm going in a little different direction here.
Okay.
Because I think remakes should be reinterpreted, not just remade.
Sure.
Bill Murray.
Yes. Bill Murray should just be in
everything. He should be in everything.
I agree.
That's it. I think, I mean, there are guys I was trying to fit in there, Dave Chappelle, Louis C.K., Dave Cross. I'd love to see them. But the great thing about this movie is that they had so many cameos in this movie that we could get them in there somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
All right.
Well, I think we were very successful.
I believe so.
And I feel like when David comes back, we'll probably have more such discussions on... If David comes back,
yeah.
About remakes. So.
He could be in the stomach of T'Challa.
That concludes another episode of Skullface Island. As always, you can call the Skullface Island hotline at 980-272-0111 or email us at skullfaceisland@gmail.com. And be sure to tweet us at Skullface Island. And like our Facebook page at facebook.com/Skullface Island. Tim, now that the show is over, I'm actually noticing that there is a purple sock on the doorknob after all. Do you
really?
I'm not going in there.
No.
Do you want to send Martin maybe?
Yeah, we could. It could be a kamikaze mission.